Now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. And Father Sky says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, 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 yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. Say, take good care of us. Please do not hurt us. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. And we are here to be ourselves, to be with one another, to be with our surroundings, to be, and we are here to take care of ourselves, to take care of one another, to take care of our surroundings, take care, to Nahastan anila nijone go shavotya, nijone go shavotya. Hey, hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo.
Akwe, greetings. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat Kiddushi Native American Center. We are broadcasting on RFPI, Radio for Peace International, Global Community Radio. Akwe, welcome. This is your host, Ones Pritzker. Wolf Mountain Radio focuses on protecting Mother Earth, defending native lands and indigenous peoples throughout the world. Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices presents the situations facing Native peoples throughout the world with Native news, interviews, music, commentaries, and investigative reports. This program serves to protect sacred Mother Earth and the traditional cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Please listen now to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Ho, Kanawantakwasin, to all of our relations. Music from the Eastern Eagle Singers off their ABBA record CD, Sacred Flight. The name of that Mi'kmaq song was The Drum. As most listeners to Wolf Mountain Radio know, the Native American drum is considered the heartbeat of our tribal nations. We honor our drummers, whose songs honor Mother Earth and our traditional cultural lifeways. Ashkwe, greetings and hello, everyone. Welcome to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. In today's program, we focus on the situation in Lebanon, as well as issues of concern in the Islamic world. My guest today is Mr. Fahou Jaber. The subject of what's now called Middle East Affairs is a very complex topic. This part of the world has a long cultural history, not to mention political, economic, social, religious, military, and environmental issues of importance. I do not profess to have a deep knowledge or understanding of either the historical or contemporary situations of the region. However, as someone interested in international affairs and concerned for peace, human rights, social, economic, and environmental justice, I consider it very important to try and learn about these issues and stay informed about events in this part of the world. I hope today's conversation with Mr. Fahou Jaber contributes to better understanding of what is happening in Lebanon. This is in keeping with Yad Kiddushi Native Center's mission statement, which in part reads, quote, Yad Kiddushi Native Center serves to inform, educate, and enlighten people about important issues facing the well-being of all life on our planet, unquote. We here at Yad Kiddushi Native Center may not agree with some of the views expressed by today's guest. We do, however, consider it very important to listen with an open mind to the comments of Mr. Jaber. I would like to now welcome Mr. Fahou Jaber to the program. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Ernest. My name is Fouad Jaber. I am a Lebanese citizen and I'm a resident of the United States. I have lived in Lebanon until I was 25 when I came to the United States to do my PhD in hydrology, and I'm currently residing in Southwest Florida where I work as a research scientist.
My friend, as most listeners to Wolf Mountain Native Radio know, I always like to have people hear what is the correct name of their person's homeland and to hear a little bit about the geography and even ecology of the area, because there are a lot of misstereotypes, especially about Lebanon and Lebanese people. Would you please share your perspective about the geography and culture of Lebanon?
As it's known in Arabic or Lebanese, Lebanon is a very small country. It's nearly the size of Rhode Island on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. It's a country of approximately 3.5 million people to 4 million. There aren't clear census numbers. It's a mountainous country. It's, in fact, the name Lebanon, Lebanon, comes from the name of the mountain, which is the Mount Lebanon. And mountains run from the north to the south of the country. So all along the country, there's a very small coastal area in the west of the country where most of the big cities are located. And then there's a small plateau where most of the agriculture happened after the mountainous zone. Lebanon's history, Lebanon is known throughout the world as being the homeland of the Phoenicians, which are supposedly the first people who created alphabet. They're some of the first sailors of the world, and as a result, the first traders around the Mediterranean, definitely, but also some people say farther along the coast of Africa. The country became Arab or Arabic after the emergence of the Islamic religion and eventually the Islamic conquest of most of the Arab world. And an Arabic country, by definition, is a country that speaks the Arabic language. There is no identified ethnic group as Arabs. And since the country speaks Arabic, we are an Arabic country. Lebanon identifies itself mostly, and there's like with the surrounding area that is mostly known in geography as the Fertile Crescent. That area is currently divided into Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, and some parts of Iraq. And there's the culture of this area in general is close to each other, and even the dialect spoken is very close, with difference in accents. After the different Islamic dynasties that have come, eventually the Ottomans were the rulers of most of the Islamic world and the Arab world. Ottoman leader at the time, or Ottoman sultan at the time, wanted to divide it at some parts. Sometimes the south of Lebanon was part of a greater area that had its headquarters in Acre in Palestine currently. Sometimes it was joined to Beirut. Sometimes Beirut was joined to Damascus. So there was a lot of interaction, and Lebanon proper was not clearly defined, except for the fact that the Lebanese mountain had a very clear culture, since they were higher than everyone else and were harder to control, like the coastal areas. After World War I, Ottoman rule was in the area, and there's a lot of reports about the Ottoman cruelty, and there is a lot of historical accounts of how the Ottomans were tyrants in the area and prevented the people in the area to have their own culture and self-decision. Even they had problems with the Arabic language. After World War I and the defeat of the Ottoman Empire at the hands of the Allies at the time, Lebanon, the whole Fertile Crescent area, which identified itself sometimes as larger Syria, was divided between the French and the British in an agreement called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, in which it was decided to give Syria and Lebanon to the French, under French rule, and Palestine and Jordan to be given to the British and be under British rule. And this was in direct conflict with promises they had given the Arab leaders in Saudi Arabia now, that were promised to be allowed to have achieved their dream of one Arab country that would include Syria, Lebanon, and all the greater Syria area.
Fahoud, listening to your remarks about the cultural history of your homeland, it sounded very similar to the colonial history of the United States and Canada towards my indigenous peoples of what's now called North America. The demarcation of Lebanon by Great Britain and France by the Sykes-Picot Agreement seems similar to the creation of the U.S.-Canadian border that had no regard for the traditional cultural geography or native spirituality that is based on sacred homelands.
And
Off the CD entitled Farouz, Jerusalem in My Heart. The name of that beautiful song was Bisan, which I believe is the name of a village. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. My guest today is my Lebanese friend, Mr. Faoud Jaber. Sir, my next question focuses on the state of Lebanon's environment. You are a hydrologist, and as you know, I am an ecologist. We both are very concerned about our biosphere, the global environment. It is my understanding that Lebanon in ancient times was greatly forested, with a rich diversity of fauna and flora. Coastal areas used to support a healthy fisheries. In modern times, Lebanon has become devoid of trees. Her watersheds now suffer serious soil erosion and water runoff, which, as you know, contributes to eutrophication of the aquatic littoral zone. Lebanon's wildlife species, like in many other countries of the Middle East, are now very rare and highly endangered. The state of the environment is also important for the health and well-being of the human community. A polluted environment or ecosystems whose habitats have become degraded directly impact the quality of life for people, especially the world's poor. Clean air, clean water, fertile soil, forests, and healthy seas is a right of all peoples. I've read a number of UN Environment Program reports on the Middle East that point out the urgent need for conservation and the restoration of ecosystems, both for nature and human beings alike. Faoud, would you please comment on this topic?
It's a very good question. Lebanon was a very forested area across the centuries, but because of it, in fact, being one of the first places on Earth to be urbanized, really, the result has been thousands of years of cutting trees. You know, there are reports even in the Bible of the whole country being a large cedar forest. And if you go to Lebanon today, the old forest trees are not more than 3 acres left. There has been attempts in the 60s of this century, of 20th century, to replant some parts of the mountain with cedar, but with the high density of population in the country, unfortunately, there's very few spaces for new forest, and there's also a high soil erosion problem. In fact, it's been for centuries, it's way before now, you know. In fact, even agriculture in the area is made with terracing now, because there's so much soil erosion. There's wildlife, you know, there's so few wildlife in Lebanon. There's few wolves and foxes, although history books and even natural resources book about wildlife talk about hundreds and hundreds of different animals. But now from a lot of people in Lebanon that there's practically no one now. There's very little. Like when they see a hyena, it's such a rare sight that you know, it's a story in the newspaper. There's also been problems later during a civil war in Lebanon between 1975 and 1990. And the lack of environmental education resulted in different people shooting at birds that were migrating in the air, which was very unfortunate. In fact, even until now, it's emerging. There's an environmental movement emerging, but there's still a lot of work to be done so that people know how to respect nature much more.
Faoud, I want to refocus our conversation on what I term the colonial era, when after World War I, France in 1923 divided your homeland from what was previously referred to as Greater Syria. Would you please talk about this colonial history?
After 1918, when the French took over the power or the control of Lebanon and Syria, they at first did not divide the two countries, and people felt more or less that they're from the same area, Syria and Lebanon. But in 1923, the French started the policy of trying to separate Lebanon from Syria, and their main purpose in that was that Lebanon had a high percentage of Christian people, while Syria was approximately 90% Muslim, and they figured that in order to have an eternal ally in the Middle East, they should cut off a piece that would have a majority of Christians. That's how Lebanon was born. In fact, the history of the delineation of the border of Lebanon, the current borders from Syria, talks about traveling around villages. This village is Muslim, let's keep it in Syria. This village is Christian, let's put it in Lebanon. And it looks like this S curves all along the border. They crushed any attempt at independence. There was a lot of Arab nationalist movement growing at that time, because it's been a movement that's been going on for hundreds of years since the Ottoman. And so they crushed all these feelings and encouraged a lot Lebanese nationality. They told the Lebanese, you are different, you're not like the other Arabs, you know, you should be proud of your Lebanese nationality. And in addition, there's 18 different official sects between Christian and Muslim in Lebanon. In order to make sure that their allies, which at the time were the Maronite Christians, be in power, they came up with a constitution which institutionalized the differences in the religious power. So the way it is, and it's still until now, the president, for example, the president of the republic has to be a Christian Maronite. The prime minister has to be a Muslim Sunni. The head of the parliament, the president of the parliament, has to be a Muslim Shia. The vice chair of the parliament should be a Christian Orthodox. And this is how it's institutionalized at the top of the governance. But in reality, the system was enforced in all different places and offices. Like, for example, in the government, it's impossible to get a job unless they make sure that there is this equal amount of that sect versus that sect. And this thing, during the 25 years of colonialism, was so enforced that Lebanese people just got used to it. And in 1943, during World War II, when France was at war and it was divided into pro-Nazis and anti-Nazis, the Lebanese took this chance and started an independence movement, which culminated in November 22, 1943, in the independence of Lebanon. Lebanon became an independent country, officially called the Republic of Lebanon.
What was the United States' attitude or policy towards Lebanon in the colonial era? It's my recollection that President Wilson, who was involved in the formation of the League of Nations, which later became the United Nations, was supportive of a number of new countries joining the world community. Did America support Lebanese independence after World War II?
After World War I, when they were making the, Society of Nations, the American role was, in fact, a positive one. At the time, Woodrow Wilson was encouraging the emergence of small countries and more independent countries, especially from Europe, because in his view, probably such countries would be more willing to work with the Americans. But at that point, he was, overruled by the French and the British, which were large colonialist nations at the time. And, you know, he didn't see fit to fight too much for it. And then after that, because we were under French occupation, that was the American involvement was limited until 1958. In 1958, there was the very pro-Western government in Iraq was overthrown by Arab nationalists. That government, which was very pro-Western and pro-American, this act made most of the Western countries very afraid that there's going to be a global change in all the countries. In Lebanon, there was practically a small civil war between the president, which was pro-American and pro-Western, and a large chunk of the population that was very Arabist or pro-Arab, and they saw Jamal Abdel Nasser, which was the president of Egypt at the time, as the leader that's going to unify the Arab nation. And that small civil war that's been going on was threatening to the Americans, especially after that coup in Iraq. And the next day after the Iraq coup, the Marines went into the beaches of Lebanon at the demand of the pro-Western president. There was a threat of a very bloody confrontation between the rebels in the street and the American army, which was 10 times better equipped than them. For some reason, calmer mind prevailed. And at that point, there was a negotiation between the different parties and a third neutral party, which was represented by the chief of the army at the time, which ended with the agreement of the president to resign and the rebels to take their arms out. The chief of the army was one of the big players in this negotiation to become the new president. So that was the first direct involvement of Americans in American politics. And from this moment on, the U.S. had a big interest in the country, especially because they saw that such a country to be on their side would be a very good thing. You know, it's located strategically in the center between Asia, Europe, and France. It's on the north of one of their greatest allies, Israel, and any change in Lebanon could prompt changes all over the Arab world and reduce what they see as anti-Americanism, which might lead eventually to anti-corporate America, which is very scary to the Americans.
Many of the comments you've described, history of your country, is so similar to the history of Native American nations in North America, of how land was taken and how European American powers determined current reality. So I can very much understand much of what you're saying. It's very analogous. I'd like to please talk about now the current situations as it's commonly described in the mainstream media, the war that is currently going on between the State of Israel and Lebanon and its Arab neighbors.
Let me start by talking a little bit about the background of the Israeli-Arab conflict. In 1948, 3 years after the end of World War II, there was all these circumstances which allowed the British to fulfill the promise of their prime minister 50 years ago, Balfour, to the Zionist movement that he will give them a piece of land in Palestine in order for them to declare as their own country, Israel. In 1948, after World War II, the British were in control of Palestine for 30-40 years at the time. The Jewish people were coming out from big suffering due to the Holocaust and Nazi injustices in their name. And in general, there was a big racist feeling in all of Europe, and the moving most of the Jewish population of Europe into Palestine was serving both purposes. The Jews will find a homeland. They always called themselves a nation without a land, and Israel was their land, and the Europeans felt like, you know, that would ease the tensions of all this racism happening around. This was a perfect plan, except for the fact that they forgot that there are people who live in Palestine. The Palestinian War in 1948, when many Jews started migrating to Palestine, and in the beginning they were welcomed by the Arab population as just people wanting to live in their area. But eventually small bands started and that started attacking Arab populations, and this eventually culminated into a full-scale war against both British forces, which in order to scare them out, to make them leave Palestine, and the Arab populations. And by 1948, these small-scale wars became full-fledged and resulted in the Palestinian population fleeing their villages in the thousands. Once these Palestinians fled, the Jewish troops at the time, which eventually became Israeli, prevented them from going back to their villages and put settlers into those villages and eventually declared the State of Israel. A few Arab countries in the surrounding, including Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, which were all very young nations at the time. Lebanon was 5 years old, Syria was 4, Jordan wasn't even completely a state yet. They still had British troops, and Egypt was ruled by a very pro-Western king at the time. And those countries looked like they wanted to fight and get back Palestine, but they were defeated very easily by the very organized Israelis at the time. The main result of that, the 48 war, was that there were hundreds and thousands, in fact, thousands of Palestinian refugees that were without a home at that time. And those refugees fled to Lebanon, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. In Lebanon, which was standing on a very precarious sectarian balance, the inflow of thousands of Palestinians, which were mostly Muslims, endangered the situation. And so one political decision taken by the Lebanese government at the time is that these people will sit in refugee camps because eventually they're going back. And there was a United Resolution, 194 at the time, that declared that all refugees should go back to their land. And the resolution still stands today, but has not been applied for 50 years. The Israeli-Arab conflict had another big flare-up, which was in 1956, when the Egyptian New Revolutionary Council, led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, declared the nationalization of the Suez Canal, which until that time, even though being in the middle of Egypt, was owned by British and French firms and governments. And in 1956, when Gamal Abdel Nasser nationalized the canal, it was a big blow to both England and France. So they sent troops to Israel and joined with Israel into attacking Egypt in order to occupy the canal and take it back from the Egyptians. Only American interference, which at the time had no stake into the canal, and were hoping that the new Revolutionary Council in Egypt will join their side against the Russians, because we were in the middle of the Cold War, stopped that invasion at the time. But what this invasion did, it showed that Israel in the region could be a very dangerous platform for the Western countries to apply their own agenda. Again, in 1956, all Arab countries were still very weak, because while Israel was beginning to accumulate armaments and connection, because they had this big reputation of being a new country, you know, the country that has come up from the ashes of World War II, and now they're building a whole new society. So there was a lot of sympathizer for Israel at the time in the world, as is now, in fact. The next conflict was in 1967. In 1967, the Palestinians the Palestinian refugees, had started organizing, and there was a lot of calls for liberation and lots, because they have noticed that now it's been 20 years or 19 years since they have been kicked out of their homes, and nothing had happened to them. They have been living in those makeshift refugee camps in southern Lebanon, in Syria, in Egypt, in Jordan. The conditions were very bad, and no one cared, it seems. And so the Palestinian movement started developing into a liberation organization, which eventually resulted in the Palestinian Liberation Organization led by Yasser Arafat. And also, Gamal Abdel Nasser was a rising star, and people thought that he could or might start, you know, helping the Palestinians in regaining their land. In a preemptive move, which reminds us of other preemptive moves that happened a couple of years ago, the Israelis attacked Syria and Egypt in a blitzkrieg, in a surprise attack. They destroyed all of the Egyptian air force, and they occupied the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, and they also destroyed a lot of the Syrian army and occupied half of the Golan Heights since then. So that was the result. And one main result is that the West Bank and Gaza, which were where the Palestinians were after the 1948 divide, you know, that land of Palestine in 1948 was divided eventually by the United Nations into Israel and Palestinian territories. And the Palestinian territories were the West Bank and Gaza. In 1967, Israel went and occupied both these places, and now the whole of Palestine was under Israeli control, in addition to the Sinai Peninsula and part of the Golan Heights. This had a dramatic result, because now all the Palestinians were under occupation, and there was a lot of refugees from that new war. A lot of people fled both the West Bank and Gaza, and that added to the refugee problems that were in the surrounding countries, which in 1970, 3 years later, that influx of refugees increased the size of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was based in Jordan. And what happened is that the Jordanian king got very scared that the PLO is becoming a state within a state that is beyond his control, and with the help of his friend in Washington, and also through his connection with the Israelis, started a war against the Palestinian Liberation Organization that was very bloody, and very few people at the time could believe that Arabs could attack Arabs with such cruelty. Lebanon declared that they would take the Palestinian Liberation Organization at the time. And Lebanon was encouraged by rich Gulf Arab countries. They're like, if you take the Palestinians, we'll pay you a lot of money. And Lebanon was like, okay, we'll take the PLO. And so the PLO in 1970 moved from Jordan to southern Lebanon and established itself there and occasionally attacked parts of northern Israel. But really, from 1970 to 1975, the attacks were very limited. You know, they were just mostly show-off. You know, not show-off. Like, they were mostly, like, just big media events, you know, like bomb, kidnapping a plane, stuff like that. And the unfortunate result of these attacks was that the PLO got the reputation of being a terrorist organization, and it allowed, you know, the big Israeli propaganda machine made people forget that those people are refugees. They have been kicked out of their land less than 30 years ago at the time.
When the spring comes again to Big Mountain, the Hopi again plant their crops, and the Diné again herd their sheep out into the meadows and the hills, as we have done since before the whites came. Since long before there were laws written down in books and enforced with weapons of steel. My grandmother told me that Big Mountain is a home of the one who created humans, where the wind breathes life into the air, where the tree of life was planted and is nurtured. The people live on the land, and the land holds the people. It holds our present, our past, and our future as well. It holds our stories, our songs, and the bones of our ancestors. It is where we have buried the umbilical cords of our newborns, an eternal bond to the earth. The people say that to move away from the land would be to disappear and never to be heard from again. But beneath the soil, the land holds other treasures. To the big corporations like the Peabody Coal Company, the U.S. Congress, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Mormon Church, the military leaders who can once again order the guns against our peoples. The Peabody Coal Company tears the skin from the land of the poor whites in Appalachia to strip for the treasure of coal. If they would do that to their own people, how much more eagerly would they do it to the land of the Indians? They have a law, a new law, to add to the thousands of old laws, and this one may be the worst of all, because it is aimed at the heart of the people. Public Law 93531 says that we are to leave our land, to leave Big Mountain. They say that we must relocate, that we must sell our herds of sheep, the herds of our great-great-grandmothers. They say there is to be no more construction on our lands. They say we must be gone by July 7th of 1986, or we must face the guns of the National Guard. But to move away means to disappear and never be heard from again. In 1890, 300 unarmed Lakota Indians were massacred in South Dakota at a place called Wounded Knee, and the memory lives in the land. In 1973, 300 militant members of the American Indian Movement occupied a part of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota at a place called Wounded Knee, and the memory is a part of the land. The Cherokee in the Trail of Tears, the Cheyenne in the Long Walk, and the massacres on the Pahasapa and at Pine Bluff, the uprisings of Crazy Horse and of Sitting Bull, the countless thousands murdered with bullets, with smallpox blankets, with broken promises and broken treaties. The memories of all of these are a part of the land and live today again at Big Mountain. They say that among the Palestinians, the people do not say, "How are you?" but rather, "How is the land?" And 3 million Palestinians live for the day of return. In South Africa, 23 million black people live on 13% of the land, and the poorest land at that. Because 4 million whites claim the rest for themselves and all the wealth beneath it. In Puerto Rico, the land is defiled by the chemical and pharmaceutical companies and by the U.S. military bases. And as with Native women, one-third of the Puerto Rican women have been sterilized. But the land remembers the people and waits for them, and the waiting will not take forever. The people at Big Mountain have not moved away. We have not disappeared. We have chased off the federal work crews trying to finish the fence that would separate the Hopi from Diné. We are constructing a resistance encampment. We are being joined by AIM warriors and Indian activists from all nations. Every people must decide what it is they will fight for, what is most important for them to survive as a people. The Palestinians and South Africans and Puerto Ricans fight for their land, as do the people of Appalachia, and those in the cities without land fight for what they need to survive, for jobs and housing and food, for justice and for dignity. The Diné and Hopi fight for Big Mountain, to hold it from Peabody Coal Company and from the National Guard, to hold on to our past and to defend our future. July 6 is the culmination, the last ceremony in a 4-year cycle to prepare for war. Big Mountain is Wounded Knee. It is the Forest Sun Dance. It is the Trail of Tears and the Long Walk. It is Plymouth Rock. It is the native villages of Guatemala and the fishing villages of the Puget Sound. It is a long and mighty river that is always flowing. And as more people learn of this struggle, it will be strengthened, as a river is strengthened by all the many streams that flow into it on its way to the sea. The Diné and Hopi will not move away. We will not disappear. And we will be supported in our resistance.
You are listening to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat Kedichi Native Center. Yat Kedichi Native Center defends Mother Earth and the cultural lifeways of indigenous peoples throughout the world. Yat Kedichi Native Center is an intertribal, culture and arts, environmental protection, social justice, and news media organization. Yat Kedichi Native Center portrays Native peoples and their worldviews in a more accurate and in-depth depiction of both our ancestral and contemporary cultures. Yat Kedichi Native Center serves to educate by providing a deeper understanding of our diverse cultures, arts, values, histories, and contemporary situations. Yat Kedichi tries to honor traditional ways by instilling an appreciation and respect for Mother Earth and tribal peoples throughout the world. Yat Kedichi Native Center educates the public on important issues facing indigenous communities. We work in support of intertribal, cultural, environmental, and social justice issues by networking with other organizations and events which share our concerns. Yat Kedichi Native Center serves as a focal point for Native news and information. We maintain a documentary library for networking with the Native and international press. Yat Kedichi Native Center's Speakers Bureau provides spokespersons for school programs, conference speakers, and community presentations. Yat Kedichi Native Center is experienced in planning, promoting Native forums, symposiums, powwows, and cultural events. Yat Kedichi's Mishkwinataki Environment Program protects Mother Earth through conservation and restoration projects. Yat Kedichi's Environmental Education Program focuses on curriculum development, teacher training, and nature field trips. We are members of the professional organization, the North American Association of Environmental Education. Yat Kedichi's Kinonwatakwisin Native Arts creates quality handcrafted traditional and contemporary fine arts. Please request our catalog of custom flutes, pottery, beaded necklaces, bracelets, earrings, leather pouches, hat bands, and chokers with bone. Yat Kedichi Native Center's Wolf Mountain Radio Program, Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, honors Native American and Indigenous peoples throughout the world by being a voice for our ancestors, contemporary, and future generations. Please write us for our catalog of audio tapes available for purchase. Native peoples throughout the world are concerned for the well-being of Sacred Mother Earth, tribal sovereignty, and respect for cultural lifeways. If you appreciate hearing Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, we ask you, our listeners, to help financially support our program to stay on the air. Wolf Mountain Radio is an all-volunteer production. Any financial contribution to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices will be greatly appreciated. We thank you for listening to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Please feel free to contact us about our consulting services, or if you or your organization is interested in hosting a speaker or educational forum. To contact Yat Kedichi Native Center, write to Yat Kedichi Native Center, 1731 16th Avenue Northeast, Naples, Florida, 34120, USA. Yat Kedichi Native Center sincerely thanks you. Aho, Kinawatakwisin, to all of our relations.
The song you heard prior to our Yat Kedichi Native Center program identification was entitled Song of Big Mountain, from the All People Singers, recorded back in the 1980s, when Wolf Mountain Radio was broadcasting from Boston, and when we were very active in the In Defense of Sacred Lands Project, which supported traditional Dene Navajo and Hopi resistance to U.S. government forced relocation under Public Law 93531, the so-called Navajo-Hopi Indian Relocation Act. As most listeners to Honoring Mother Earth and Indigenous Voices know, the United States government still continues its war on Mother Earth and harassment of traditional Dene Navajo and Hopi in the Big Mountain Black Mesa area to further exploit the energy and natural resources of that sacred Indian land for coal, water, and uranium. Wolf Mountain Radio continues to broadcast news about this case, as Yat Kedichi Native Center remains very active in supporting the traditional Dene Navajo and Hopi in defending their land and cultural lifeways. Worldwide listeners can learn more about this historic struggle by visiting the Black Mesa Indigenous Support website. Their website is www.blackmesa.org. Once again, visit the Black Mesa Indigenous Support website, www.blackmesais.org, or write to Black Mesa Indigenous Support, P.O. Box 23501, Flagstaff, Arizona 86002 USA. Thank you for listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. I want to thank today's program guest, Mr. Fau Jaber, for sharing his views with us. Please listen next week for program 2 of my conversation with Faud. We shall conclude today's broadcast with a song from Shoshone Navajo Okanogan flutist Hovaya Edwards off her Canyon Records CD, Morning Star. The name of the song is Sacred Waters Flow. This is your host and producer, Ones Pritzker. Aho, Kinon Wantakwasin, to all of our relations. You are listening to the American Indian Movement's Honoring Song. This is Wolf Mountain Press, a documentary program focusing on Native lands and Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Wolf Mountain Press will present the situations facing Indian peoples throughout the world with Native music, poetry, news, and Indian case histories in the struggle to protect Mother Earth and the sacred ways of life of Native peoples.